Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 2nd Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Sheriff, three feared dead, 991 structures burned, by Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. It's going to be a long road ahead, by Noel Phillips, Elizabeth Hernandez, Saji Hindi, and John Aguilar. COVID-19, New Year's Day Rose Parade marches on despite virus surge, by the Associated Press. Albuquerque, 21 rescued from aerial tram cars, by Eduardo Medina and Vimal Patel, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Sheriff, three feared dead, 991 structures burned, by Conrad Swanson, The Denver Post. Three people are missing and are feared to have been killed by the Marshall Fire, Boulder County Sheriff said Saturday, contrary to officials' earlier declarations that nobody was unaccounted for in the wake of this week's raging wildfire. Two people are missing in Superior, and one is missing in the Marshall area, Sheriff Joe Pelley said at an afternoon news briefing. Each of their homes was lost to Thursday's wind-driven wildfire, the sheriff said. The search has been hampered by smoldering debris, then snowfall, Pelley said. Sheriff's officials plan to bring out cadaver dogs Sunday, he added. Their homes are destroyed. Potentially there are human remains in those homes, Pelley said. The debris is hot. It's all fallen in, and now it's covered with 8 inches of snow. Pelley also announced that preliminary tallies show 991 structures, 553 in Louisville, 332 in Superior, and 106 in unincorporated Boulder County were destroyed by the fire, and 127 more were damaged. The Boulder Office of Emergency Management has posted a list at boulderoem.com. The cause of the 6,000-acre wildfire, the most damaging in Colorado history, remains under investigation, Pelley said. Investigators have found no evidence pointing to downed power lines as the fire spark, as first had been suspected, the sheriff said. Acting on a tip, Pelley said, investigators have served a search warrant on a local property while probing the fire's cause, but he wouldn't say where or why. He also noted that investigators are examining video that has circulated on social media showing a barn on fire in southeast Boulder County. Because of high winds, all outdoor burning was prohibited on the day of the fire. Initially, Boulder County officials had said nobody was missing in the wake of the fire, but those early reports were incorrect, said Jennifer Churchill, a spokeswoman for the Boulder County Office of Emergency Management, asking for grace after the error. Many different agencies were working to extinguish hot spots, investigate the fire, keep people out of the evacuation area, and more, she said. And the mix-up stemmed from all those different people tackling everything at once. We thought we were at zero, but that was incorrect, Churchill said Saturday morning. Information is coming from multiple channels. We're dealing with COVID. Our communication channels were certainly stretched. Pelley lamented the potential loss of three lives, but gave thanks that fatalities weren't much higher. We hope that within the next couple days, we can help families and perhaps recover remains or confirm that they're not there, the sheriff said. Additional information wasn't immediately available on the missing people, but Hutch Armstrong told Nine News that his grandmother-in-law, 91-year-old Nadine Turnbull, was among the missing. Family members weren't able to help her get out of her original town superior home during the fire. They tried to go out the front door with a neighbor, Armstrong told Nine News. It was engulfed. Check the back door. It was engulfed. Boulder County officials on Saturday released a preliminary 23-page list of the homes and businesses destroyed or damaged. The fire tore through whole neighborhoods, and the list includes home after home in sequential order along streets such as St. Andrews Lane, Enclave Circle, and Eldorado Lane, the Element Hotel in Superior, and Royalty Nails and Spa, Havana Motor, and a Subway sandwich shop in Louisville were destroyed. Other businesses, including Target, Whole Foods, and Chuck E. Cheese in Superior, were damaged. Louisville Police Chief Dave Hayes said some residents will be allowed to re-enter the city. Pre-evacuation orders for the area are no longer in effect, he said. Residents within the city's soft closure area, Spyglass Circle, St. Andrews Lane north of West Dillon Road, Augusta Drive, Pinehurst Court, and Club Circle and Place will be allowed back in as long as they can present identification. Those who do return are asked to travel only during daylight hours and to go directly home, he said. They should bring bottled water because much of the area's water supply is contaminated, he added. But residents of the city's hard closure area still cannot return, he said. That area includes Fillmore Court, West Sandbar Circle, West Pinion Way, and more. Evacuation areas in Superior and unincorporated Boulder County didn't change on Saturday. Marshall Fire, it's going to be a long road ahead, by Noel Phillips, Elizabeth Hernandez, Saja Hindi, and John Aguilar, the Denver Post. Just before 11:30 a.m. Thursday, emergency dispatchers alerted firefighters to a grass fire reported near Marshall Road and Colorado 93, south of Boulder. The hurricane force winds buffeting Boulder County meant it had been a busy morning, with fire crews racing to stop two other gas fires north of the city limits. But the new fire near Marshall Road would prove to be a different beast. Powerful winds pushed the flames east, and it exploded within minutes, sending a column of smoke skyward as it burned across parched grassland toward the suburban subdivisions of Superior. Tens of thousands of Boulder County residents fled that afternoon and evening as the entire town of Superior, then its neighbor across US 36, the city of Louisville, were ordered to evacuate. The firestorm, accelerated by vicious winds and drought conditions, tore through Superior, jumped the turnpike, and burned into Louisville. By late Thursday, the Marshall Fire had burned 6,000 acres and destroyed nearly 1,000 structures to become the most destructive wildfire in Colorado history. The flames leveled a hotel in Superior and scorched the roof of the town's Target store. In Louisville, the wildfire blackened shops in strip malls along McCaslin Boulevard. Despite officials' earlier optimism that no lives have been lost, three people were missing and feared dead as of Saturday. Residents who lost everything scrounged through the rubble of their homes Friday, the last day of a trying year, with COVID-19 rates climbing once again and Denver and Lakewood still mourning the victims of a terrifying mass shooting. Others, still blocked from returning to their neighborhoods because of active fires, were left wondering whether their homes were still standing. The Denver Post spoke to some of these residents as they headed into the new year, picking through the remains of the lives they had built, and these are their stories. Lost childhood. A tear spilled down Samantha Pinto's face as she stood on the sidewalk along West Dillon Road in Louisville on Friday morning, staring at once was her family's neighborhood. It's a place where she and her friends played hide-and-seek at night, pretended to be America's top model, and invented the blanket game, which was carried out on a trampoline. My childhood is gone, Pinto, 26, said. The Pinto family, Randy, Lynn, Melanie, and Samantha, moved into their home in Coal Creek Ranch South in 2004. There, they made the kind of friends who organized softball teams and borrowed tools and invited each other onto their decks for evening cocktails. Now, an estimated 60 homes in their subdivision are gone. All of my friends used to meet at an electrical box. We'd say, let's meet at the electrical box to play, Samantha Pinto said. All of my best friends grew up in the same cul-de-sac. Randy Pinto, a family medicine doctor whose office is near a Vista Adventist Hospital, finished seeing his Thursday morning patients and looked out his office window to watch smoke billowing. He wondered why his wife, Lynn, was not bringing the sandwich he had requested for lunch. I just thought it was a typical wildfire that happens up in the foothills, and it wouldn't come down here, he said. Lynn and her daughters were too busy packing valuables and planning to evacuate to bring lunch. The family managed to save their cat, Moonshine, along with some records, artwork, passports, and other important documents. These guys were good, Randy Pinto said. They were hauling butt, preparing for the worst. Katie Doyle Myers found herself in an uneasy state of in-between late Thursday morning as winds near her Louisville home began to roar and smoke started to drift overhead. Her two kids were eating lunch with two neighborhood friends at their home on Grouse Court. She encouraged the kids to continue eating, but to do so with some urgency. Texts from friends were coming in with an increasing edge in tone. Some told her she should evacuate. You could look northeast and see blue sky. I thought, do we really have to do this? Doyle Myers said. While her youngest child asked if their house would be okay, she tried to assure him by telling him that thousands of houses to the west would have to burn first before the fire reached their neighborhood just east of the Louisville Recreation Center. Impossible, right? Is this really going to happen in our suburban town? Doyle Myers asked herself. We're not in the mountains. But as the winds picked up speed and the skies grew darker with smoke, she knew it was time to go. She grabbed some crucial documents, the family dog, their two hermit crabs, and the neighbor's cat. She pulled away from her house of 17 years, not knowing if she would see it standing again. When I got really scared was when I saw how much gridlock there was on the road, Doyle Myers said. It was this unbelievable billowing orange smoke and this ash falling on us. At that moment, her friend texted her telling her she could see half a dozen fires breaking out on the side of Dillon Road as she sat stuck in traffic. Doyle Myers saw a motorist turn a bike path through open space property into a makeshift road as they bailed on jammed up South Boulder Road to get to Baseline Road. She followed and ended up in Longmont at her place of work, where she and her family spent the night. Her husband sneaked back to the house a few hours later to grab some medicine and returned with sobering news. He came back and said, "Let's prepare ourselves emotionally," she said. "We were preparing to lose our house." But on Friday, Doyle Myers was able to drive to her house to see if it was still standing. It was, along with her neighbors' homes on the cul-de-sac. Even while houses and condos on nearby West Mulberry Street and Owl Drive had burned to the ground. A block away, there was nothing, she said. It felt super desolate. Although Doyle Myers doesn't know when she and her family will be able to return home, she said she's ready to help neighbors who weren't so lucky. We have a tiny house, but absolutely, we'll take people in, she said. Louisville has a special something to it. A long road ahead, where a six-bedroom, 3,780-square-foot home once stood at 84 Spyglass Circle, just one recognizable object could be seen in a heap of smoldering cinders Friday, a big green egg smoker. The green egg survived. Doug Johnson said it. He stood in his driveway watching the smoke billow. It's not green anymore. Johnson and his wife, Lori Draper, moved into the custom-built home in 1994. Today, they would not be able to afford it, Draper said. The couple was at home with their 30-year-old son, Lucas Johnson, and their German Shepherd, Zia, when they heard they needed to evacuate. they scrambled to load belongings, including their Persian rugs and frozen food, into their cars. At Lucas Johnson's suggestion, they took time to pile stuff into a third vehicle, even though Doug Johnson didn't think the fire would be all that bad. "You leave thinking the best, that you will return," he said. On Friday afternoon, Draper second-guessed their hurried decisions, made while frantically packing. She had saved Christmas stockings and a handmade tree skirt, but she didn't bring much that had belonged to her mother, who died 3 years ago, or the beautiful Angora sweaters that her sister had knitted by hand. "I didn't grab any of the right stuff," she said. "I didn't grab any of my mother's stuff." As Johnson and Draper watched the ashes smolder, the Pinto family walked over to console their friends. As they hugged in the street, Draper said, "It's going to be a long road ahead." 15 minutes to get out. Talis Uzzles went to Davidson Mesa near Harper Lake in Louisville on Thursday afternoon to take pictures of a wildfire burning outside of town. The flames hopped US 36, and he got worried in a hurry. "I realized it was windy enough that it might actually reach us," Ozel said. "We talked about it happening, but we didn't think it was possible." He raced home. He and roommate Brian DeLaura packed and left within 15 minutes. On Friday, their cluster of townhomes was gone. A few buildings nearby were burned partially, and others appeared untouched. Ozel peered into a pit that had served as the basement of his townhouse at 452 Owl Drive. He recognized his toolbox, now a hunk of metal, and the washer and dryer. That was about it. As he contemplated the mess, DeLaura walked up. "Jesus Christ," DeLaura said as tears welled in his eyes. "It's all gone." The roommates gently kicked two flower pots that sat by what had once been their front door. They talked about the things they wished they'd remembered to take as they evacuated. "When it got to my parents, it was so stupid," DeLaura said. "Okay, I got my skis and a couple of days' worth of clothes." The men snapped pictures at the scene to document it for insurance claims. "I don't think we're going to salvage anything at all," DeLaura said. An economic calamity. The Muckle brothers led Superior and Louisville as the community's respective mayors nearby a decade ago. Andrew Muckle, a physician who has lived in Superior for 25 years, said as he was working at Good Samaritan Medical Center in Lafayette when he got an evacuation alert Thursday. He raced back to his home in the Rock Creek neighborhood and grabbed his two dogs before starting the interminable journey. It took 1 hour to move 1 mile out of the neighborhood down Rock Creek Parkway. "Honestly, it was a little nerve-wracking," he said, as he watched smoke billowing over the tops of his neighbors' homes. Muckle's home survived. He and his family are staying with his mother in Boulder while the evacuation order is in place. He said his brother's home in Louisville also was spared the fire's ferocity. Muckle said there had been talk nearly 10 years ago when he was mayor about the possibility of a grassland fire on the expansive stretch of open space that lines the west side of town, but he and others never envisioned it jumping roads and other barriers aided by hurricane-strength winds. "You'd have McCaslin Boulevard and a buffer between McCaslin and houses," he said. "I think people were comfortable with protection from wildfire on open space." But when it moved further north and east into Louisville on Thursday, he realized the extraordinary and unprecedented power of the Marshall Fire. "Honestly, I could see how Superior might get affected, but when I saw Louisville burn, it was hard to believe," Muckle said. The former mayor, who served in that role from 2006 to 2014, said he worries about Superior's fiscal soundness going forward, with reports of damage at the Superior Marketplace, where the small town gets the bulk of its sales tax revenues. Muckle said the immediate future could be rocky. "If these businesses, Target, Costco, and Whole Foods, if they are unable to open for an extended period of time, that would be an economic calamity for the town," he said. Digging through rubble. When 18-year-old Anna Gracheva pulled up to the Louisville home she had spent her life in, only to find it burned to the ground Friday morning, a reel of memories flashed before her eyes. Hanging out in the backyard on warm summer evenings, making coffee in the kitchen, filling the rooms of the two-story home plus basement with the lively conversation of a loving family, herself, mom, dad, and brother. By Friday, all that remained was rubble and whatever Gracheva could pull up from the ashes. So far, she had found a mug from a beloved friend, a water bottle, and some china. Words can't describe what's happened here, Gracheva said. It's unimaginable. The teen had a stressful day Thursday before the Marshall fire sparked. Gracheva woke up at 6:30 a.m. to take a COVID-19 test. Then her car battery died. After jumpstart, Gracheva was driving home when a dark haze started to settle over Boulder County, she said. The family heard about the fires, but never thought they'd be impacted. It all happened so fast, Gracheva said. She began to pack a bag in case she needed to evacuate. One change of clothing, her phone and chargers, a toothbrush, toothpaste, and deodorant. That was it, Gracheva said. I just thought, of course, we would come back and it would be okay. Gracheva got increasingly anxious as reports of the fires rolled in and headed out to a friend's house while her parents stayed behind a bit longer before taking off to a friend's house with the family, dogs, and cat. She and her brother came back to the residence Friday to see how their childhood home fared, only to find its charred remains next to a basketball hoop. The siblings started digging through the rubble for keepsakes, any comforts of home they could bring into the new year. My heart goes out to everyone during this time, Gracheva said. Mourning a beloved pet. The Mayfield family cut short their trip to visit relatives in Manhattan, Kansas, and returned to Louisville to find their house in the Cherrywood 2 subdivision completely burned down. Adding to their anguish, their 2-year-old dog, Lucky, was inside. It was a very sad thing in our family, Doug Mayfield said. His 11-year-old twins are especially struggling. The Mayfields left their dog behind because their hotel wouldn't allow him. Their pet sitter had walked the dog around noon Thursday, but left before hearing about evacuation orders. When the orders were issued, the sitter couldn't get back to the house because of a closure on US 36. We couldn't do anything about it, he said. Everybody was evacuated. We didn't even know about it. Our sitter couldn't even come back. They returned to see smoking debris where their house once stood. Mayfield said it looked like a bomb had gone off inside the house. The car inside the garage appeared to have blown up. A storage shed melted all the way into nothingness. The Mayfield family is holding on to a sliver of hope that their dog somehow escaped the fire, and they plan to check the list of animals that have been found. But they know the house was secured at the time of the fire. We were hoping he was lucky, Mayfield said. We were hoping he got through a door or something. Never in a million years. To Stan Lanzano, it looked like a tornado of fire had torn through Louisville, carving a path of linear destruction in the city of 20,000 while leaving adjacent streets untouched. The band of destruction was like half a mile wide, and right outside of it, you were fine, Lanzano said. Unfortunately for the 48-year-old realtor and 15-year Louisville resident, his home was in the Marshall Fire's target zone. It ripped right down West Mulberry Street, he said. I didn't even know it was our house. There was not one defining feature to tell us that it was our house. He had somehow convinced himself that he would be able to quickly run upstairs and grab some cash he had left in a drawer upon returning to his home Friday morning. But there was no drawer, no stairs to climb. His incinerated, unrecognizable Acura RDX was just a blob. Never in a million years would I think a raging wildfire would rip down a suburban neighborhood in Louisville, Lanzano said. which is why he didn't take the evacuation orders in the form of a fire truck driving down West Mulberry, telling people via loudspeaker to get out, as seriously as he wished he had. Figuring he would be back home in a number of hours, he grabbed only a toothbrush as he and his wife and two children joined lines of cars heading out of town. Our expectation was they were evacuating out of an abundance of caution, Lanzano said. The thought never occurred to us that our house would be completely destroyed. They ended up at his sister's house in Broomfield on Thursday evening. Lanzano turned off his phone for the night, only to pick up the voicemail the next morning from a neighbor EMT informing him, West Mulberry's all gone. But already neighbors and friends are offering help. One friend told him he could have some of his climbing equipment to replace what had been burned up. Another friend offered to give him children's clothing to dress his kids. It's been very reassuring. There's a very strong sense of community, Lanzano said. Mitchell Byers of the Daily Camera contributed to this report. COVID-19. New Year's Day Rose Parade marches on despite virus surge. By the Associated Press, byline, Pasadena, California. A year after New Year's Day passed without a Rose Parade because of the pandemic, marching bands and floral floats took to the streets again to celebrate the arrival of 2022, despite a new surge of infections from the Omicron variant. The 133rd edition of the Pasadena Tradition on Saturday featured actor LeVar Burton as Grand Marshal, 20 bands, 18 equestrian units, and dozens of floats reflecting the theme of dream, believe, achieve. After days of record-smashing rains, there were sunny skies for the 8 a.m. start of the spectacle, which has an uncanny history of postcard weather. Leanne Rimes kicked off the event with a performance of Throw My Arms Around the World, followed by a military flyover of a B-2 stealth bomber. Among the fanciful floats was the futuristic-themed Vaccinate Our World entry by the AIDS Healthcare Foundation with a robot nurse clutching a syringe. The colorful Rise, Shine, and Read float by the UPS store featured a bespectacled rooster reading to a group of chicks. American Idol winner Lane Hardy performed aboard Louisiana's Feed Your Soul float. For the grand finale, the Army's Golden Knights parachute team landed along the parade route, and country performer Jimmy Allen sang Good Times Roll. The parade and the afternoon Rose Bowl football game between Ohio State and Utah were held despite an explosion of COVID-19 infections in Los Angeles County, where daily new cases topped 27,000 on Friday. The County Department of Public Health said it was the highest number of new cases. The soaring infections had prompted Kaiser Permanente to announce that its float, A Healthier Future, would not have 20 frontline medical heroes riding or walking alongside. We must prioritize the health and safety of our frontline medical staff and ensure we are able to treat patients during this recent surge of COVID-19 cases caused by the Omicron variant, the healthcare network said. The parade drew thousands of fans, as usual, along its 5.5-mile route. Many camped out on sidewalks overnight, staking out their spots in the afternoon on New Year's Eve. Pasadena authorities urged people to wear masks, upgrading to the N95 or KN95 types, and to avoid mingling with anyone outside their own groups. Many attendees wore face coverings, as did Rose Parade Queen Nadia Chung and her court. The Tournament of Roses Association said ticket holders for parade bleachers and the Rose Bowl game were required to show proof of full vaccination or a negative COVID test within 72 hours, and masks were required for everyone aged 2 and up. The 2021 Rose Parade was canceled months ahead of time. The Rose Bowl football game was played after being moved to Arlington, Texas. Previously, the parade was canceled for several years during World War II, and the 1942 Rose Bowl game was played in North Carolina after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Albuquerque, 21 rescued from aerial tram cars by Eduardo Medina and Vimal Patel, the New York Times company. The restaurant workers walked into the aerial tram car about 9 p.m. Friday, their shifts complete, their moods festive, even with a lashing wind and heavy snow. Amber Santos stood beside the trash bins they had carried inside the car, which reeked of food leftovers from 10-3, a restaurant at the top of Sandia Peak near Albuquerque. Almost home, she thought, as she felt the tramway system, which shuttles people to the restaurant 10,300 feet above sea level, start to move. 20 people were in one car, and one person was in another. 19 employees of 10-3 and 2 employees of the tramway system, who were headed home to celebrate 2022. Then, near the second tower of the tramway, the car stopped. At 10 p.m., nothing. At 11 p.m., still no movement. Finally, the countdown until 2022 had, for those stranded, become a countdown until their rescue. It would take more than 12 hours. As temperatures dipped into the mid-20s, the passengers resorted to rationing Lifesavers gummies and 6 bottles of water as they spent the first few hours of 2022 waiting for rescue crews to arrive. By Saturday afternoon, all of the stranded passengers had been rescued. No one was injured, officials said. Spencer Moreland, an incident commander for New Mexico Search and Rescue, which provided about 30 volunteers who helped in the rescue, got a call from the state police at 3 a.m. He was on the scene by 4 a.m., and an hour later, rescuers had begun the more than 4-hour hike up the steep terrain in a snowstorm. Rescuers had to get to a tower, climb to the tram, and set up a rope system to lower people to safety, he said. From there, they hiked with the passengers about 100 yards to a landing site, where a helicopter whisked them away a few at a time. Rescuers battled treacherous conditions, said Larry Corin, the pilot who flew the stranded to safety by landing his helicopter on a narrow ridge. Corin, who was also the undersheriff for the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office, said members of the Sheriff's Office, along with other local officials, had trained with the tramway operator for just such a situation. Such a rescue was one that they had considered but never executed, he said, adding, and we never expected it would be for 21 people in a snowstorm. Michael Donovan, general manager of Sandia Peak Aerial Tramway, said wind and ice had caused an emergency cable to cross over another cable, preventing the tram cars from reaching their destination. When warning of rare disorders, these prenatal tests are usually wrong, by Sarah Cliff and Atish Bhatia, the New York Times company. After a year of fertility treatments, Yael Geller was thrilled when she found out she was pregnant in November 2020. After a normal ultrasound, she was confident enough to tell her 3-year-old son that his brother or sister was in her belly. But a few weeks later, as she was driving her son home from school, her doctor's office called. A prenatal blood test indicated her fetus might be missing part of a chromosome, which could lead to serious ailments and mental illness. Sitting on the couch that evening with her husband, she cried as she explained they might be facing a decision on terminating the pregnancy. He sat quietly with the news. How is this happening to me? Geller, 32, recalled thinking. The next day, doctors used a long, painful needle to retrieve a small piece of her placenta. It was tested and showed the initial result was wrong. She now has a 6-month-old, Emmanuel, who shows no signs of the condition he screened positive for. Geller had been misled by a wondrous promise that Silicon Valley has made to expectant mothers, that a few vials of their blood, drawn in the first trimester, can allow companies to detect serious developmental problems in the DNA of the fetus with remarkable accuracy. In just over a decade, the tests have gone from laboratory experiments to an industry that serves more than 1/3 of the pregnant women in America. luring major companies such as LabCorp and Quest Diagnostics into the business, alongside many startups. The tests initially looked for Down syndrome and worked very well. But as manufacturers tried to outsell one another, they began offering additional screenings for increasingly rare conditions. The grave predictions made by those newer tests are usually wrong, an examination by the New York Times has found. That includes the screening that came back positive for Geller, which looks for Prader-Willi syndrome, a condition that offers little chance of living independently as an adult. Studies have found its positive results are incorrect more than 90% of the time. Nonetheless, on product brochures and test result sheets, companies describe the test to pregnant women and their doctors as near certain. They advertise their findings as reliable and highly accurate, offering total confidence and peace of mind for patients who want to know as much as possible. Some of the companies offer tests without publishing any data on how well they perform, or point to the numbers for their best screenings while leaving out weaker ones. Others base their claims on studies in which only one or two pregnancies actually had the condition in question. These aren't the first Silicon Valley firms to try to build a business around blood tests. Years before the first prenatal testing company opened, another startup, Theranos, made claims that it could run more than 1,000 tests on a tiny blood sample before it collapsed amid allegations of fraud. In contrast with Theranos, the science behind these companies' ability to test blood for common disorders is not in question. Experts say it has revolutionized Down syndrome screening, significantly reducing the need for riskier tests. However, the same technology, known as non-invasive prenatal testing, or NIPT, performs much worse when it looks for less common conditions. Most are caused by small missing pieces of chromosomes called microdeletions. Others stem from missing or extra copies of entire chromosomes. They can have a wide range of symptoms, including intellectual disability, heart defects, a shortened lifespan, or a high infant mortality rate. Not every patient is screened for every condition. Doctors decide what to order, and most companies sell microdeletion testing as an optional add-on to the Down screening. Most test makers don't say how often their microdeletion tests are being performed, but it is clear some of the tests are in widespread use. One large test maker, Natera, said that in 2020 it performed more than 400,000 screenings for one microdeletion, the equivalent of testing about 10% of pregnant women in America. To evaluate the newer tests, the Times interviewed researchers and combined data from studies to produce the best estimates available of how well the five most common microdeletion tests perform. The analysis showed that positive results on those tests are incorrect about 85% of the time. Experts say there is no single threshold for how often a test needs to get positive results right to be worth offering. They note that when the tests do accurately identify an abnormality, it can give expectant parents time to learn about and prepare for challenges to come. Some said one common microdeletion screening for DeGeorge syndrome, a disorder associated with heart defects and intellectual disability, has the most potential to do good. There are a few restrictions on what tests makers can offer. The Food and Drug Administration often requires evaluations of how frequently other consequential medical tests are right and whether shortfalls are clearly explained to patients and doctors. But the FDA does not regulate this type of test. Alberto Gutierrez, former director of the FDA office that oversees many medical tests, reviewed marketing materials from three testing companies and described them as problematic. After being presented with some of the Times reporting, a half dozen of the largest prenatal testing companies declined interview requests. They issued written statements that said patients should always review results with a doctor and cautioned that the tests are meant not to diagnose a condition, but rather to identify high-risk patients in need of additional testing. In interviews, 14 patients who got false positives said The experience was agonizing. They recalled frantically researching conditions they had never heard of, followed by sleepless nights and days hiding their bulging bellies from friends. Eight said they never received any information about the possibility of a false positive, and five recalled that their doctor treated the test results as definitive. Some women began tentatively planning abortions after receiving positive screenings. I couldn't help but have termination on my mind, said Allison Michalik, 33, whose screening incorrectly indicated her baby might have Turner syndrome, which can cause infertility and heart defects. Studies show that the test's positive results are wrong 74% of the time. She lived in Indiana at the time and recalled scrambling to arrange follow-up testing before the state's 22-week abortion ban. From 2011 to 2013, a small Silicon Valley-based biotech company, Sequimnam, tripled in size. The key to its success? Maternity 21, a new prenatal screening test that did remarkably well at detecting Down syndrome. Older screening tests took months and required multiple blood tests. This new one generated fewer false positives with a single blood draw. The tests also could determine the gender of a fetus. It quickly became a hit. You had people walking in saying, "I want this sex test," recalled Dr. Anjali Kamal, a maternal fetal medicine specialist at Massachusetts General Hospital. Competitors began launching their own tests. Today, analysts' estimates of the market's size range from $600 million into the billions, and the number of women taking these tests is expected to double by 2025. As companies begin looking for ways to differentiate their products, many decided to start screening for more and rarer disorders. All the screenings could run on the same blood draw, and doctors already order many tests during short prenatal care visits, meaning some probably thought little of tacking on a few more. For the testing company, however, adding microdeletions can double what an insurer pays, from an average of $695 for the basic test to $1,349 for the expanded panel, according to health data company Concert Genetics. Patients whose insurance didn't fully cover the tests describe being billed wildly different figures, ranging from a few hundred to thousands of dollars. But these conditions were so rare, there were few instances for the tests to find. Some companies test for conditions so rare that there are few known examples for comparison. Both LabCorp, which purchased Sequenom, and Myriad Genetics offer screenings for one disorder that is so rare its prevalence is unknown, and another called Jacobson syndrome that affects one in 100,000 births. Dr. Diana Bianchi runs a National Institutes of Health laboratory studying prenatal blood screenings. She said of Jacobson syndrome, "I've never seen a case of that in my 20-plus years of practicing genetics." 2021 ends as Chicago's deadliest year in quarter century, Byline Chicago. 2021 ended as one of the most violent on record in Chicago, as a rise in the number of shootings left more people dead than in any single year in a quarter century, according to statistics released by the police department on Saturday. According to the department, 2021 ended with 797 homicides. That is 25 more than were recorded in 2020, 299 more than in 2019, and the most since 1996. And there were 3,561 shootings in 2021, which is about 300 more than were recorded in 2020, and a staggering 1,415 more shootings than were recorded in the city in 2019. Other cities have also seen an increase in the number of homicides, but Chicago, as it has in previous years, ended 2021 with more homicides than any other U.S. city, including New York and Los Angeles, both of which had recorded at least 300 fewer homicides than Chicago for the year as of late December, according to police data from those cities. We all know this has been a challenging year here in the city of Chicago, Police Superintendent David Brown said at a news conference last week. Too many families are reeling from the loss of loved ones due to the senseless gun violence. Brown said most of the homicides are the result of conflicts between rival gangs. He has tried to highlight some positive statistics when discussing the monthly crime figures, and he continued to do so with the release of the end-of-year statistics. He said, for example, that the department cleared 400 homicides, a total that was higher than any year in nearly two decades. The department said it took a record 12,088 guns off the street in 2021. That total coincided with the creation of a gun investigations team that is focused on interrupting the flow of illegal guns into the city. This report was from the Associated Press. In a news brief, assessment of Loveland Police is expected this month, byline Loveland. The investigation and assessment of the Loveland Police Department that was initiated after the release of information about the 2020 arrest of Karen Garner is expected to be released this month, according to a Loveland official. Justine Bruno, assistant to the city manager, said the timeline for releasing the report was pushed forward when the city asked Jensen Hughes, the company leading the assessment on the department and the parent company of Hillard Heinz, which conducted the investigation, to expand the scope and outreach for its assessment. This included adding a second town hall held in person in October to hear from the community. Bruno said the organization also conducted more interviews. They had a lot of stakeholders that wanted to speak with them as well, she said. The independent investigation into the police department was announced in June, several months after local attorney Sarah Schilke released information on the arrest of Garner, a 74-year-old woman with dementia, following an incident at a local Walmart. Schilke filed a lawsuit against the city and the department. While the civil case ended in a $3 million settlement, two officers involved, Austin Hopp and Daria Jalali, face criminal charges after their resignation from the police department in late April. Hopp is scheduled to appear for a six-day jury trial in April, and Jalali is scheduled to appear for her next deposition hearing this month. Hopp and Jalali, along with former officer Paul Ash, who faced criticism and was named in a lawsuit tied to a 2019 arrest that also ended in a large settlement from the city, have been placed on the Brady list in Larimer County. The document is a compiled list of law enforcement officers whose involvement in a case, whether as arresting officer or otherwise, could impact their integrity. The list is maintained by the local district attorney's office. Former officers Hopp, Jalali, and Ash are among 24 total officers in Larimer County from the Loveland Police Department, the Larimer County Sheriff's Office, and the Fort Collins Police Services, who are on the list, according to documents received from the Larimer County District Attorney's Office. They are the only Loveland officers on the county list. This was by Austin Fleskus, the Reporter Herald. Going out when they still like me, Platte Valley Superintendent McLean to step down in June, by Annie Delaney, the Greeley Tribune. Glenn McLean received a warm welcome when he was announced at a Platte Valley Elementary School holiday assembly in Kersey. The 57-year-old superintendent visited the school December 17th to lead Christmas carols for the last time in an official role. McLean is retiring at the end of the fiscal year in June after more than 30 years in the district, including 23 years as superintendent by the time he steps aside. When elementary school principal Jason McNair told the approximately 520 students of McLean's final visit as superintendent, a few oh no's could be heard in the gymnasium. McLean has been in the school district long enough to have taught parents of the current elementary students. CU will start semester remotely because of COVID-19 and impacts of fire, by Kiernan Nicholson, The Denver Post. The University of Colorado will begin the spring 2022 semester remotely January 10th, with in-person instruction scheduled to resume January 24th, campus officials announced Friday evening. A rise in COVID-19 cases and local impacts of the destructive Marshall Fire prompted the remote start, according to a CU news release. By delaying our in-person return until January 24th, we are doing our part to support the community, said Chancellor Phil DeStefano in a message to the campus community. The remote start will allow us to provide the support needed to our impacted students, faculty, and staff who may not be able to teach or attend classes in person. It will also help us provide resources in support of community-wide recovery efforts. Faculty members and staffers are encouraged to work remotely during this time if possible. In his message, DeStefano shared details about the launch of a new website at colorado.edu/fire-resources for the campus community. Boulder County Public Health reported a record-breaking 535 new coronavirus cases Wednesday, surpassing Tuesday's 436, which was the largest single-day total since the onset of the pandemic. The U.S. on Tuesday also broke a record when the seven-day average of cases topped 267,000. The Daily Camera contributed to this report. Assistance for seniors and some with disabilities raise for home care help. Officials say $15 hourly minimum is first step toward fixing workforce shortage image problem. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. People who care for seniors and those with disabilities in their homes will get a wage boost in 2022. But even the plan's biggest supporters called it a first step rather than a crowning achievement. The Colorado Medical Services Board voted unanimously December 10th to raise the amount the state pays through Medicaid for home-based care and to require agencies to use that money to pay the people providing the care at least $15 an hour. Home-based services are cheaper for the state than nursing home care, and older adults tend to prefer to stay in place. Previously, the state didn't set a base wage for care workers. Agencies had to pay only the overall minimum wage, which is $12.32 statewide, or their municipality's minimum, if that was higher. State officials estimated about 47% of direct care workers receive some form of public assistance because of their low incomes. Federal COVID-19 recovery money will allow the Colorado Department of Health Care Policy and Finance to fund the increase through mid-April 2023. The General Assembly will take on the question of whether to extend it by passing a permanent rate increase, which is included in Governor Jared Polis's budget request. The increase will affect an estimated 10,000 to 15,000 workers, said Lauren Chevalier, founder of People Care Health Services and a board member of the Home Care and Hospice Association of Colorado. Even as they approved the plan for a temporary increase, some board members raised concerns it wouldn't be enough to recruit and keep workers in a challenging field, where demand is only going to grow as the population ages. We're competing with Starbucks at $17 an hour and McDonald's at $15, board member Dave Pump said before the vote. It doesn't go far enough, but it is so much better than where we were before. Cody Jakubowski, a direct care worker in Denver, said the increase won't solve the problem of low wages, but it's progress. Although the $15 base wage won't affect him because his current private pay clients offer more, he got involved with the campaign to raise wages because other care workers have family responsibilities that don't leave them the time to get involved in advocacy. Hopefully, it means an easier step to $17 an hour and $20 an hour, Jakubowski said. There's caregivers on Medicaid taking care of clients on Medicaid. Jakubowski, who said he lives in his van, called it a strange kind of privilege to have that option for getting by on low wages. For the first time, he has a small savings cushion. There's a pretty good chunk of care workers that have been homeless, Jakubowski said. But most direct care workers he knows have children and can't reduce their expenses by foregoing rent, he added. About 87% are women, and a higher percentage of people of color or immigrants than in the labor force as a whole, according to a 2019 report from the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute. The Joint Budget Committee already voted in favor of the temporary raise, but Representative Julie McCluskey, the committee's leader, said it's too early to know which requests the members will prioritize. I think it's critical at this moment that we begin thinking about frontline and essential workers, she said. Candace Bailey, director of the Colorado Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing's Home and Community-Based Services Division, said the state will study whether $15 accomplishes the goal of increasing the home care workforce, but she expects more increases will be needed. The federal COVID-19 recovery funds offered a unique funding opportunity to retain more caregivers, said Jessica Coral, a participant-directed programs contract specialist at HCPF. The state's population is aging, and the number of people working in direct care hasn't kept up, she said. Older adults and people with disabilities will continue to struggle to access long-term care if we don't grow the workforce, she said. Brenda Lozado, a direct care provider who lives in Aurora, said she appreciates the efforts to raise the base wage, but $15 an hour isn't enough to cover the basics in Colorado. She said it helps that she lives near a bus stop, which cuts down on the cost of getting to and from clients' houses and a nursing home where she works part-time. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.